Okay. So good morning, everybody. First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for setting up this nice workshop and for giving me the opportunity to tell you something. This talk will be kind of a little bit old-fashioned in two respects. So first of all, I will use these beautiful blackboards in order not to confuse myself with always thinking about this freeze button for the second screen. And then it will not be about tensor powers of channels, but just ordinary powers, so not tensor products, but just ordinary products of channels. There are two things I would like to address. One direction you could title with the the first part will be about analysis of time series. Okay, and the second part is about what one may call quantum Wieland inequalities. Okay, now we'll explain you, of course, what this means. Okay, but let me set up a little bit of notation. I will mainly talk about quantum channels, but also I would like to contrast from time to time quantum channels with classical channels. Yeah, so let me give you some notation for both of them, for the quantum world and for the classical world. Also, we talked a lot about quantum channels. I just wanted to set up some notation. So my favorite letter for a quantum channel is P, and since I want to concatenate channels or take powers of a channel, the input dimension has to equal the output dimension. Yeah, so this will be a linear map from the d times, from complex value d times d matrices onto d times d matrices. And then there will be these two constraints. So I will usually regard this as what physicists call the Schrödinger picture. So it will be a trace preserving map. And so for a row, the rows are density operators. So positive semi-definite with trace one. But in this context, it doesn't matter. So these maps will be trace preserving, and they will be completely positive. So if we tensorize with the identity map on a d-dimensional matrix space, then this is positive. Now, in the classical world, a channel is described by what people call a stochastic matrix. So we don't want to map density operators onto density operators, but probability distributions on probability distributions. And then my favorite letter is S for stochastic matrix, of course. And this is itself, if you have d degrees of freedom, it's a real-valued d times d matrix, and these two restrictions are then, on the one hand, that S is stochastic in the sense. Okay, so at this point, I think steal the first transparency of Marius because he had all these things there. If we take the sum over I, then this should be equal to 1 for all j. And complete positivity in the quantum world is just the analog of S being a non-negative matrix in the sense that each entry of S is positive. Okay, and then in the first part, I would like to talk about the evolution of expectation values. Yeah, so we have some observable, which let's say we call this H, which evolves in time, and then we will have two different models for this evolution. So one is, in the quantum world, we have this quantum channel, and we take the tth power. Okay, so tth will be just an integer, could be zero. Okay, and we apply this quantum channel T times to rho, and then we take the Hilbert-Schmidt scalar product of the trace with respect to some Hermitian operator H. Okay. Now classically, this expectation value is obtained by starting with some vector of probabilities, applying the stochastic matrix T times to this vector, and then taking the scalar product with some real vector, which we might call H. Okay. Okay, so now I would like to address the following question. So let's assume that that this is given data. So some experimental physicist measured something, and this is what he obtained. And then we can model this either quantum mechanically or classically. And I will start with the quantum mechanical world. Yeah, so what we are given is with the sequence, okay, which is whatever, okay, and of course there are discrete points, but it takes longer to draw discrete points here. So this is a given sequence, and now the question is what can we say about the quantum mechanical representation when we do not know anything else? Yeah, so we're just given this sequence. What can we say? And the original motivation for this question was that there's this the question about assessing the dimensionality of a quantum system. We already heard a little bit about this in the talk of Carlos, where he told us that if you have a multipartite quantum system, a bi-tripartite quantum system, and you check the correlations, and they give rise to a Bell violation, which is larger than square root of t, then you know that one of the underlying Hilbert spaces has to have at least dimension d. But of course, there are some unknown prefactors around, so it's not very, for experimental physicists, it's not very practical yet. So this is another approach. Say you have this time evolution given, and then you ask, what would be the minimal dimension, Hilbert space dimension, which is required in order to represent this time evolution. Okay. I can think about two ways of tackling this problem, and one is what one could call method of delays. At least this is what people working in classical chaotic dynamics call it. And this goes as follows. So we construct some vectors, so some elements of L infinity. Let's call these V tau in the following way. So we take the sequence. Now this entire sequence gives us one vector, one element of L infinity. Yeah, so this is H. So this is tau H tau plus 1 and so on. And we do this for every non-negative integer tau. Okay, so every tau will give us such a vector. Yeah, and from this time series, they are constructed by taking the entire time series and taking the entire time series and disregarding the first two, the first three, and so on components. So this will give us vectors. Yeah, and since I assume, at least for the moment, that we have an infinite series, these are vectors in the same space, so they span some subspace, which I will call calligraphic V. So this will be the linear span of all these vectors. Yeah, and these vectors are sometimes called delayed vectors, because you just delay and then take this time series in order to construct these vectors. Okay, so now the first small observation which has, however, very nice applications, is that the dimension of the space gives us a bound to the dimension we need in order to represent this time series or this the sequence of expectation values in using quantum mechanics. So there's a small theorem which tells us that the dimension of this space spanned by these delayed vectors plus the dimension of some other space, which I will tell you in a second what this is. Let's call this calligraphic C. That this is lower bounded by d squared plus 1. Yeah, and d squared is now the dimension of the Hilbert space which is required in order to represent this thing. Okay, so what's the C? So this is the space of, you could say, conserved quantities. So it's the space of Hermitian operators. Such that the expectation values do not depend on time. Now, of course, this space, this depends on T and rho, yeah, but in some physical context, we might know something about this, about the space of conserved quantities, because there are some symmetries which give rise to conservation laws. Okay, and then this is just this is the dimension of this metric space. Okay, so this is a very useful but very simple result. It's very simple because the only thing you have to realize when you want to prove this is that T is a map, of course, on a d squared dimensional vector space, which means that T to the power 1, T to the power 2, up to T to the power d squared plus 1, they are linearly dependent. Yeah, so there's an annihilating polynomial, and you could say that so one way of seeing this is using the Cayley-Hamilton theorem, no, which tells you that that a linear map is the solution to its own characteristic equation. So this gives you some linear dependence. Yeah, so then this and these d squared plus 1 maps become linearly dependent, and then it's a small exercise from this observation to prove this statement. You can also say something about the cases of equality. So one can show that the equality holds in this theorem. If and only if we have a look at the dual channel and then the orbit of the observable H. Now, if this orbit spans the entire metric space. Okay, so it's some kind of ergodicity, you know, which is required for equality, and this is an if and only if, but this tells you in particular, because you can easily construct examples where this is the case, so this tells you that in a sense this is an optimal inequality, and yeah, this is tight. Okay, so let me remark a little bit on what are the applications of this observation. So one application is, of course, that this gives you a lower bound. So from starting with observable data with these expectation values, this gives us a lower bound to the dimension of the system. But you can also think about applying this in some other contexts where you know the dimension of your system, but you don't know how good some of the assumptions are, or one of the assumptions is in order to represent the time evolution like this. Because I mean, here we make two assumptions when we write this down. Yeah? One assumption is that the time evolution is homogeneous. Yeah, so we apply the same P again and again. Yeah, it could change over time. The other assumption is that the time evolution is, at least on the time scale where the observation is done, is Markovian in the sense that for every point in time, the state of the future only depends on the present state and not on the history of the present state. Yeah, so this is one assumption. Of course, this, in principle, you could say, well, this this assumption can, in many cases, at least approximately, be made true by increasing the dimension of the space in which the evolution takes place, because you just add the relevant degrees of freedom in the environment to your evolution space, and then this gives you a bound. So if the dimension of the system is known, but the memory space of the environment is unknown, then this gives you a bound on the relevant degrees of freedom, or in the degrees of freedom in the environment which keeps some memory. Okay, this one, one can generalize this a little bit in various directions. So, for instance, one simple direction is that if you have more expectation values, so you have more observables, or you take higher moments of one observable, then you can do exactly the same construction, and then you just add other rows to this vector, so then you have a matrix, and what counts is the span of this matrix space, and then the same theorem holds again. Okay. So now you might ask, what about a converse to this theorem? And there's a converse, but I don't know whether this converse is tight. Yeah, so what one can show is that maybe I should use a different blackboard. Okay, so this theorem continued. Conversely, if we have such a sequence, and this is bounded, so this is L infinity, then there exists a density operator, a Hermitian operator H, and the quantum channel T in dimension, the dimension of the space spanned by the delayed vectors plus 2, such that this sequence has a representation of this form. Yeah, so this is a converse of this theorem. But here I don't know whether this is optimal. So this plus 2, I need plus 1 in order to make things trace preserving, and another plus 1 in order to make things completely positive. I would guess that this linear relation is optimal. Yeah. Okay. I mean, you realize that there's some gap in between, because this tells you that that D is lower bounded by the square root of the dimension of these delayed vectors. So there's some gap in between, but I think this gap this has to be there, because the dimension of the space simply doesn't give you all the information. Yeah, in order to get more information, you have to use some structure of the space and not only its dimension. Okay. Okay. So this is one way of obtaining some information from such a time series. There's one other way, which is using the discrete Laplace transform of this sequence, which is sometimes called the set transform. Yeah, so we have some complex function which we define as 1 over set sum t So this is a function in the complex plane, And now, okay, there, if we now consider these two cases, you know, the quantum case and this classical case, then they give rise to very similar expressions. Now, in the quantum case, we get that this is trace H set identity minus T inverse applied to rho. Yeah, so this is in the quantum case. In the classical case, it's just the same, but with these stochastic matrices replacing the completely positive maps. So we have set times identity matrix minus S, the inverse of that, applied to P, and then the scalar product with the observable vector H. So this is okay. Why is this useful in order to get some information? This is useful because this tells you that the poles within the unit disk, the poles of the set transform, they give you eigenvalues of either the stochastic matrix S or the completely positive map T, which describe the evolution. Yeah, so the poles of L give eigenvalues of T, or if you want to describe this classically, S. Okay, so what do we know about eigenvalues? In fact, we don't know much about eigenvalues of quantum channels. But we know that in both cases, the eigenvalues are always, they are inside the unit disk. There's one eigenvalue 1. The eigenvalues are either real or come in complex conjugate pairs. I mean, this is, in the quantum case, about everything we know about these eigenvalues. In a classical, so if you want to describe this classically using the stochastic process, we know more, and there are more restrictions on the eigenvalues. Now, in the quantum case, if you only have a look, okay, so this is, let's say, the unit disk in a complex plane. In the quantum case, there's no further restriction to every single eigenvalue. Even in dimension 2, we can get an eigenvalue everywhere. Yeah, we can choose, and then we can write down a completely positive trace preserving map which has an eigenvalue here. Yeah, there's no further restriction. Only on the combined set of eigenvalues, there are restrictions which we don't know at all. No. The spectral radius is always 1. I mean, if for non-unitary, of course, if you I'm considering trace preserving maps or unital maps. No. Every positive trace preserving map has spectral radius 1. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So in a quantum case, there's no further restriction. In a classical case, this is, however, not true. And in a classical case, there's for the eigenvalues of a stochastic matrix, there's a restriction coming from the dimension. Yeah. Yes. Exactly. Yes. The singular values can be up to square root of d or something like that. In a classical case, so if we have a stochastic matrix in dimension d, then we know that the eigenvalues are all contained within a region which can be obtained by taking the convex hull of all roots of unity up to order d. Okay, so this means that in dimension 2, all the eigenvalues are on the real line. Now, in dimension 3, we add this triangle, take the convex hull, so all the eigenvalues are contained in here. In dimension 4, all the eigenvalues are contained in here. Okay, but now you see that there's always a region outside. I mean, for every finite dimension, there's a region outside, and we can easily construct, for instance, a process which is realizable by a two-dimensional quantum system, but for which we, however, need an arbitrary large-dimensional classical system or classical representation in order to describe, to represent this time series. Okay, it's not a very deep observation. It's just, in the end, it's saying that probability amplitudes are much better to describe or to represent oscillations than probabilities themselves. But at least we can use this the information coming from the Laplace transforms or coming from the poles of that in order to separate a quantum mechanical and a classical description in terms of the dimension which is required for the representation. Okay, and this separation can be arbitrary large, but it's not a very deep statement in the end. Okay, so let me comment a little bit on what to do when we have either finite or noisy data, so how robust these observations are. Now the first thing is, so let me come back to over here. This is quite robust, I would say. So the way, so what we can do, we have to erase something. If we don't have a half infinite sequence of data points, which is some a finite collection, then we can construct a matrix, say VKL, like this. And let's say that K and L, they run from 1 to some capital N. So we only have a finite sequence. Now this dimension of the matrix is of course bounded, or the rank of this matrix is of course a bound for the dimension of this vector space, of the space spanned by the Dirac vector. And so we have the dimension of V of this vector space is bounded by the rank, lower bounded by the rank of V, and equality holds this dimension is, so if this N exceeds the dimension of this vector space. Now if you assume that that V is not what we observe because there's some error coming, for instance, from finite statistics. So let's say we observe some V prime, which is V plus some V epsilon, where this V epsilon is bounded in operator norm by some epsilon, which we can in turn estimate from, if you know something about the errors, where they come from statistics, then we can get an estimate on this epsilon. And this is what we observe. Then we can further bound this by by some singular value of this matrix V prime. So this is a minimum K, where Sk plus 1 of V prime is smaller than epsilon. Now these Sk are the ordered singular values of V prime. So in the end, what we have some data which we observe. We have some noise estimates in terms of this operator norm. And then just by looking at this data, we can get a bound to what we would like to have. So I mean this is what this dimension is what we want to estimate, and this is what we get here. And then you can play a little bit around with this, and it turns out that this is quite robust. So this epsilon doesn't have to be epsilon; it can be 10% of the signal, and you still get some reasonable information out of this. With the second method, this is no longer true, at least not that I know, because the problem is that this only converges somehow outside the unit disk, and then you have to, by analytic continuation, get the poles inside the unit disk. But this analytic continuation is, to get error bounds for this is, I don't know how to do this. You can make a lot of effort, and messing around with this Padé approximants, and then you get error bars like this. The information is lost. So I don't know how to make this robust. Okay, I think this is everything I wanted to tell you about this time series analysis. There are a couple of open questions. I would like to I'd be very happy if we would know more about the spectrum about completely positive maps, because we don't know anything at all. If I give you a couple of points in the unit disk, can this be a spectrum of a CP map in a certain dimension? And I guess this would also help. I'm sure there's some information in this This context would also help in order to show that, for instance, this converse here is really is tight, because we have some good candidates for showing that this is tight. And if we would know more about the spectral properties of CP maps, then this might give a proof. Okay, but yeah, I would like to move on to the second topic, which is a little bit related to the first one, namely these Wieland inequalities. Yeah, and this is somehow this we had as an open problem in the last operator structure and quantum information conference in Banff. So it's about homogeneous matrix polynomials. And okay, up to some constants, this is no longer an open problem. Thank you. Okay, so this is the second part on, let's say, quantum or classical Wieland inequalities. Okay, so let me give you two equivalent formulations of the problem. Yeah, so the problem is the following. We have a set of matrices, say A1 to AN, and these are complex valued D times D matrices. And then we have a look. We look at the span, so we call AK the complex linear span of all monomials of degree K. Yeah, so some AI1 product up to AIK. Yeah, so when you have a look at homogeneous polynomials of degree K in these matrices. And then we ask for the dimension of the space. Yeah, so in particular, I would like to know, so the question is, if there exists some K such that these polynomials span the space of all matrices. Yeah. Does this imply that this is already true for some K which is a function only of the dimension of the matrix space? Yeah. So is there some D tilde which only depends on the dimension of the matrix space, for which these homogeneous polynomials already span the entire matrix space, if they span it eventually? Yeah, so this is the question. If you want to formulate it in terms of homogeneous matrix polynomials, but okay, now in our business there's a much nicer formulation about the rank of the Choi matrix. Yeah, so the alternative problem would be, we will now interpret these A's as Krauss operators of a CP map. Yeah, and then we concatenate, or we take powers of the CP map, and we follow the rank of the Choi matrix. Yeah, so we follow the minimal dilation space in the Steinspring representation. Yeah, and then we ask, if eventually this dilation space is maximal, is it already maximal at some point which only depends on the dimension of the system? Can we give some bound to that? Yeah, so we have, let's say, if chi of T is the Choi matrix of T, yeah, then the question is, if chi T to the, okay, it's a little bit fishy, to the infinity, I mean, which means that if there is some large K such that this is positive definite, Yeah, the question, is there some P prime such that the Choi matrix of T to the power, or some D tilde, such that the Choi matrix of T to the power D tilde already has full rank? And we want to have this D tilde as a function of D, so the dimension of the matrix space only. Okay, and this, it sounds like an odd question, but in fact it has lots of applications in the context of quantum spin chains, and you can also think about some nice applications in the context of quantum channels, of course. And I will comment on this a little bit later. But now I will tell you why I call this bound quantum Wieland inequality. Because classically it's called Wieland inequality, so you might call it quantum Wieland inequality. So classically, so Wieland inequalities are the following. So if you have a stochastic matrix, D by D stochastic matrix, and we assume that this becomes that there's some, let's say, some k such that s to the power k is strictly positive. Okay, now, well, this is a different order. I mean, this strictly positive means component-wise. Every element is really positive. Then, what Wieland proved is, so if this is true, then these matrices are called primitive matrices, and this has lots to do with graph theory in the end. If you interpret this S as an adjacency matrix of a graph. Okay, but what Wieland showed is that if this is the case, if a matrix is primitive, then S to the power, let's say, D prime is positive, where D prime, okay, the, want to discuss two cases, but D prime is D minus 1 if the diagonal entries of S are positive, or in general, D prime is something like D squared minus 2D plus 2 if there's no restriction, no further restriction on S. Yeah, this is what Wieland proved, what he however never published. Yeah, so it was then published by other people. And this is—it's not so difficult to prove, because in the end, we don't use a lot of structure of this S. We only use whether or not some entries are non-zero. Yeah, so we can replace all non-zero entries by one in this matrix. And this is why most of the proofs are of graph theoretical nature, where you interpret then this matrix as an adjacency matrix of a graph, and then it's about about walks on this graph, and then the proof is not too complicated. But of course, in a quantum case, there's no analog. Yeah, so we cannot replace something by one. I mean, it's a very different problem. I don't know how to use graph theory. I don't think that there's a way. Okay. And at the very beginning, we were not sure whether there exists a dimension dependent bound in a quantum case, because it's such a different problem. But using what I told you in the very beginning, it's obvious. I mean, one can easily see that there is a dimension-dependent bound. And I will show you how this works. But the bound will be very, very, very bad. I mean, it will be beyond exponential, so to say. But it only depends on the dimension. Okay, so what we want to do is we want to bound the rank of the Choi matrix. Yeah, so we have T. We want to have a look at the determinant of the Choi matrix, as a function of this power. Yeah, so we have t to the power of some integer small t, tensor the identity applied to, okay, let me call omega the maximally entangled state. And then we want to get handle on this determinant as a function of t and use the first result. So how can we use the first result? We linearize this thing by brute force. Yeah? So what we do is we take, so we say, well, this determinant, okay, now this is, this thing here is an element in m d squared, right? So it's a d squared times d squared matrix. Now this determinant we can get by taking the d squared fold tensor product of the thing with itself, and then by projecting to the totally antisymmetric, or by taking the weight in the totally antisymmetric subspace. Yeah, so this is something like a trace, and then this projector onto this totally antisymmetric subspace, and then we have t to the okay, so how to write this? Okay, but this is now the maximum entangled state in this larger space, right? Okay, so this is something like this. And this is exactly the structure which we had in the first part, right? So this is a power of some quantum channel, and we have a look at this time series here. Yeah, but now this acts in dimension d squared to the power d squared. Yeah, so this is an element in M of this thing here. Is an element in here. Yeah, so the dimension becomes huge, of course, by making this stupid tensor product trick. Now let's assume that this determinant as a function of t, so this determinant is zero for all t smaller than some k, yeah, but non-zero for, or small or equal k, for t k plus 1. Yeah, then this means that the dimension of this, of the space of D-like vectors will be at least k. Okay, and this we bounded by, from above, by the square of the dimension of this space. Yeah, so this is bounded from above by d to the 4 times d squared. Yeah. Okay, now this gives us a dimension-dependent bound, which is horrible. Yeah, and it's, okay, and let me tell you in 2 minutes or so how to, okay, maybe not how to improve this bound, but how better bounds look like. Yeah, this was just to somehow to connect these two parts a little bit and to show you that obviously a dimension-dependent bound exists. Okay, so quantum Wieland inequalities. Okay, so now we have a completely positive map. And we are assured that if we take a power of this map, that eventually the rank of the Choi matrix, so we get a Choi matrix with full rank, yeah, so the minimal dilation space in the Steinspring dilation is maximal, so to speak, then we can get a dimension-dependent bound. Okay, there are three cases which I would like to mention. One of them is if in the span of our Krauss operators there's an invertible element, yeah, then this is simple. Yeah, then one can easily show that every step one has to increase the rank of a Choi matrix. One can show that whenever there are two powers, subsequent powers where this rank does not change, then it remains constant throughout. So if it eventually becomes full rank, then it becomes full rank already after d squared minus one steps. Okay. The other cases are much more tricky than the case often than cases where there exists an invertible Krauss operator. So there's one case where this d tilde is, let's say, of order d to the cube if there exists an a such that a to the d is non-zero. Which means that there's a Krauss operator or an element in the span of Krauss operators which has an eigenvalue, a non-zero eigenvalue. This is what we need. And in general, we can show that that there's a bound which is of the order of d to the fifth. In this case, I know that this is optimal, so you cannot do better. In these two cases, I don't know that this is optimal. So it might well be that that in the end, these two cases, these different scalings are just artifacts of the proofs we have, and that you get this d squared scale. I don't know. Let me just for Toby mention one application which is out, not related to quantum spin chains, although most of the applications and very nice ones are in the context of quantum spin chains. So what does this mean? So this means, for instance, that the one implication is that if you have a unital quantum channel, so unital and trace preserving, and then you have a look at the zero error classical capacity, and you know that, so you take the d tilde power of this channel, and if this is different from zero, then you know that this zero error capacity of t to the k is larger equal to one for all k, which somehow means that if you interpret this channel as the as some transmission line or some optical fiber, and the d is the length of this optical fiber, then there's a critical length in the sense that if there's a capacity, if you manage to have a capacity after this critical length, then you manage to have a capacity for arbitrary length. There are very nice many applications in the context of spin chains, but I don't have time to tell you about these. So thanks a lot for your attention.